Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 371st episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta in the Department of Family Medicine. And you may notice a change in the sound quality or maybe the wisdom, but I'm presently at a Toronto office.
Yes. So if there are some audio hiccups, we apologize, but hopefully it will work well enough. And, you know, it really isn't what we say. It's just us being there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And for the Canadians to understand where I am, it's Toronto.
Yeah. All you have to do is look at a map of the USA and put an arrow up. So now that we've basically insulted everyone in the world, why don't we get on to a podcast? And Mike, for the first time in
a long time,
about 20 years, we're going to do a few question and answer podcasts. And we've, like I said, as we always do, we just go through a number of questions from people. And when I was putting this together, there had been a few that I actually had not responded to some people. So I very much apologize to the people who we've not responded to. If after listening to the podcast, we still haven't answered your question, please feel free to send me those questions again. Oftentimes what happens is I'll read them and go, oh, that's going to be difficult to answer. And then it falls to the bottom of my inbox. So,
or you send an email back saying, sorry, James McCormack doesn't live here anymore.
Yeah, or I forward it to you. So, in fact, this first one is one of those types of questions. This comes from Anne, and it says, and she said, I would love to hear a podcast about iron supplements and IV iron infusion and maybe even blood transfusion. So you can imagine just doing that is an awful lot of work to try to put together, especially it's not something, I mean, we talk about iron supplements, but I would imagine you don't spend a lot of time doing blood transfusions, Mike.
No. And even we try and avoid iron infusions, but when we do it, it's a laborious task to make happen in my community anyway.
Yeah. And I'll paraphrase the question. It was just saying, as a colleague of mine suggested, there's no evidence for multiple tabs of iron per day, regardless of the severity of anemia. And he said one ferrous fumarate is just as effective as other regimens like ferrous gluconate and so on and so forth. And so I can at least deal with that one, because we do have, and this is a study we presented many, many years ago, I believe.
Millions ago, yeah.
Yeah, and there is a study that looks at, I think, comparing 15 milligrams of elemental iron to 50 to also 150 milligrams of elemental iron. And 150 milligrams of elemental iron is the typical dose that you see recommended for anemia from most most sort of monographs will tell you that. And this was a relatively small study that just looked at elderly people with anemia, and it made no difference in how quickly their hemoglobin responded, whether they used, interestingly, 15, 50 or 150. So a tenth of the dose did just as well. And I think you remember that study, Mike.
Yeah, for sure. And we did it as a tools for practice. Yeah. And then we published it in Canadian Family Physician as well, because I just think this is such a great little study about dosing.
And the big difference was an absolute reduction, I think, in the neighborhood of 50 or 60% in the chance of GI side effects.
So at, you know, 2 months or so, the hemoglobin had come up 14 if you're using Canadian units, or 1.4 if you're using units from the United States. In all three groups, as James mentioned, there was no differences between them. But as he mentioned, there's a huge difference in actual harms, and the number needed to harm for dropout due to adverse events was 5. The number needed to harm for abdominal cramps was 2. That's 150 versus 15. So really, there's really no point in giving high doses. These were elderly patients who were given these different doses. And we want to remind everyone that you still have to work them up for the cause of their anemia. But you don't really need to give them high doses. So what does to understand what does 15 milligrams of elemental iron translate into. So I'll just go over this quickly. So 300 milligrams of ferrous fumarate is 100 milligrams of elemental iron. 300 milligrams of ferrous sulfate is 60 milligrams of elemental iron. And 300 milligrams of ferrous gluconate is 35 milligrams of elemental iron. So ferrous glucate is the lowest of them. So if you're looking to make something equivalent to this study, you would, and you wanted to give a tablet, you would choose something in the ferrous gluconate realm. Now you can also, if it comes as a tab, you could even break it in half. If you want to give it as the accurate dose, for those of you who have ever prescribed it, there's a ferrous sulfate syrup or ferrinsol, and that is either 2.5 mils or 1 mil, depending on the potency that you buy, but it can be quite small. So, you know, these medicines come with a lot of different, the amount of elemental iron varies quite considerably, depending on the formulation. So just to be aware of that. So patients on ferrous fumarate, 300 milligrams TID are getting 300 of elemental iron. So you can imagine if 150 was enough to cause GI distress and dropping out, what 300 would be.
And pretty much the body, you can almost sort of get away with a tablet of something a day, because we don't know the exact right dose. And even that may be somewhat overkill, but it just seems like a reasonable thing, especially because, and regardless, if you, even if you don't believe that lower doses work, you absolutely should start with those to make sure they even have the ability to try to tolerate them.
Right. And so the only caveat to all of this is the, females of reproductive age who are having menstrual cycles. So there's some evidence that females have less iron in their diet. They seem to absorb less iron, and then on top of it, they're losing quite a bit every month. So as a result, the studies that have looked at replacing women who were anemic of reproductive age shows that low doses in them doesn't seem to be as good. It might start improving some hemoglobin scores, but it doesn't really help with their iron stores. So most research has found they need those a little bit higher doses. So that's in your clinical practice, that's always finding that balance between the one tab of ferrous gluconate all the way up to, you know, 2-3 tabs of it, or a couple tabs of ferrous sulfate. So you have to kind of play around to find the right dose for the patient in front of you, but just be prepared for reproductive age females needing a little bit more than what we've discussed here with elderly patients.
Yeah. And when Mike said he was replacing women, he actually meant replacing iron in women. And I just want to make sure we're...
Well, there it is for the new year. We're into podcast number 2 and I've already ruined it.
Yeah, no. Anne had some other questions about IV iron and blood transfusions, and you know, it that would just be such a hodgepodge of information to wade into. And I'll be honest, I just didn't get to it, and I don't think, Mike, you have any pearls of wisdom either, do you?
I've already offered every pearl. Yeah, exactly. They're more like coal.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah. So if it's if you desperately need that information, email me again and we'll see what we can find. But and I guess it is a reasonably common thing, but it's just a very specific area that neither you or I are real experts in. Another one came, and I couldn't find a name off of it, because sometimes people send it just directly through our podcast. But they said, "Hi guys, love your podcast," and they appreciated it because it makes them sound smart on rounds, which is nice. And the question was all about TPA, and they said there's a huge divide between the eMERGE Med people and neurology people and so on and so forth. And I'm sure you probably remember, Mike, as well, is that there was many years ago sort of a controversy about the whole concept of, you know, is TPA good, or are the harms, do the harms outweigh the benefits? And a lot of that came down to the fact that people were looking at different things and how you look at meta-analyses and that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. And there was some, you know, what people might perceive as inconsistent results. So it might show a reduction in one study, might show a reduction in disability, but didn't show a reduction in mortality in a short time frame or a longer time frame or what have you. And so people would see those results as inconsistent. I don't know if I would, but it then becomes, there's a lot of conflict in how you weight different outcomes and different time points and outcomes. And it's easy to debate these things.
Yeah. And you also get in, and often, and we've talked about this many times in the past, you also get into a debate sometimes about, well, the p-value was 0.06, therefore it didn't work. Yeah. And in fact, that, I think if I remember correctly, many years ago, that was where, with things like streptokinase and so on, that's where there was a big debate, is it that threshold, it didn't quite get there. And so then people it did or didn't work. You know, I think that's where it all came from. So I just did a little bit of sort of digging into the evidence. And whenever I don't have a ton of time, I sort of go to the Cochrane Library. And there's been a review of thrombolytics. And, you know, the key outcomes. And it is tricky because a lot of these studies have imbalances between the groups. There's a lot of heterogeneity and so on. But when you look at the best available evidence, I think you can make a reasonable argument that these agents do have benefit, especially if used very early on. And the typical endpoints that they looked at were things like disability and dependency and obviously mortality. But in fact, none of these trials have ever shown a reduction specifically in mortality. And then the one of the most important harms is the intracranial hemorrhage. And I think that's where you get the debate is, well, you get this potential benefit, but then there's also a harm. Now, Mike, you and I were talking about this earlier. It would seem to me that if you do show a benefit in reducing disability and dependency, that kind of covers the potential problem that you might have seen with the intracranial hemorrhages.
Yeah, it because the measurement of those outcomes would account for those patients as well.
So you still would have the intracranial hemorrhages as an endpoint going up. But it's the consequences of those that are important. You still don't, by the way, I'm not saying we want one of those.
No.
Yeah, and it is a risk for using that. But here's some ballpark numbers that I was able to tweak from the Cochrane review. They looked at a combined endpoint of death or dependency slash disability and so on. And in the populations they were studying, and you obviously would have to go back specifically and look exactly what populations, because obviously probably the younger the population, they probably have less long-term disability potentially. And they had a baseline risk of either death or dependency, and most of this was disability at the end, of around 60% ballpark. And if you treat with a thrombolytic, you can get rid of about a third of that if you treat within 3 hours. So ballpark numbers, you go from 60 down to around 40. And then, but if you don't treat until sort of I think it's the sort of 3 to 6 hours, you only get about half that benefit. So you'd go from sort of, you know, instead of 60 down to 40, you might go 60 down to 50, something like that. So instead of a 20% absolute benefit, it's now 10%. And in these studies, the risk of intracranial hemorrhage increased from 2% in the placebo group up, increased it to 7%. So a 5% increase. So it seems a reasonable, especially if you can get it done early, which is why all of the you know, major hospitals have all of these stroke units where they are very aggressive at getting you these thrombolytic agents and getting them in fast.
As they should be. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. And we talked before, James, we went online recording, and one of the things here, some people get hung up on the fact that there's no mortality benefit. But if you ask many stroke patients, a lot of people, and a lot of people without stroke, when they think about stroke as, you know, the quality of life impacts, many would prefer to die than rather suffer the disability and impairments related to
especially
a more severe stroke.
Disabling stroke.
Exactly. Yeah. And so if you can modify that, I think that is an important outcome.
Yeah, no, for sure. So that's what I was able to quickly find about TPA. And again, Mike, neither you or I are specialists in acute ischemic strokes, but those are the numbers that I could find.
Now you are, James. You are.
Well, it's actually kind of an interesting thing, because how do you define an expert? Is it if you know the evidence or if you've had lots of clinical experience? And I would suggest it's both. So you need both, kind of. So we're faking it right now on the expertise in the area, but we do are hopefully reasonably good at looking at the evidence. Alex, who is a emergency physician in the U.S. and says, hi, James and Mike. And he says, because of our disaster of our healthcare system in the States, he does way more primary care than he'd really like to do. And this is to do with the podcast that we did on, you know, big blood pressure numbers, the sort of the 190s over the 130s. And he just tells a story about it is not unusual. He says, not a shift goes by without seeing an asymptomatic patient come in with a 190 over 130 who measured it at home. And then it kept going up and they decided to come in at 2 a.m. or they called for an ambulance and all those sorts of things. And he is sort of reiterating what we said, as you can say, he says, as you can imagine, this really puts me in a bind because, you know, they've been sitting in the waiting room for 2 hours. They don't want to hear that they don't need some sort of a, you know, nicardipine drip or whatever calcium channel blocker, you know, tablet or capsule under their tongue because their head is not going to explode. So, you know, and that is what people see. I'm sure you've seen it when you did any eMERGE work where people get very worried about these big numbers.
Oh, for sure. There's lots. I don't go through too long without one of my patients showing up in eMERGE or contacting us with some level of urgency because their blood pressure in the, let's say the pharmacy or where have you, was 166 or 186 or something. And preceding that, I had seen them and they had elevated blood pressure somewhere around 155 or something like that. And I'd said, well, we need a follow-up before we call this. But anyway, at home or some point, it escalated and with worry ended up leading to an eMERGE visit. So the statement that was given as they were being put in a waiting room is, he better do something this time. I was in the emergency, you know.
Yeah.
So, which I subsequently used in one of my case reports. So I'll quote similar to that. I'm not giving the exact words.
Yeah.
Probably the words, that idiot doctor better do something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But, and Alex goes on to say, you know, so he actually sort of has a very humble plea to everybody. Please do not tell your asymptomatic patients with elevated blood pressure reading to go to the emergency room because it's 4 p.m. on a Friday. it puts us both in a bad position. I'm undermining your decision by doing nothing, and I'm causing harm by doing something just because they are there and have waited for 2 hours, you know, and they feel like something should be done. So, you know, I think we're just really reiterating what we're saying is that dealing with big numbers in blood pressure is about whether or not they really have symptoms. That's the key issue.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we've talked before about trials where, you know, the mean blood pressure was, and you're going to have to correct me, James, but I think it was 190 or 200, a 200 on 110, was it?
Yeah, something like 190 on 110, 115 for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and the top blood pressure person had an average blood pressure of 280, right?
I think it was 280 over 130.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, that's high.
Well done. Yeah.
And obviously, it turns out a blood pressure intervention in those people helped.
Yeah, although the one that you're talking about was the one of the first.
I know they didn't do what they.
Yeah, they just
can they reduce it?
Yeah, and in fact, the title of that paper was the treatment of mild hypertension.
I know, with propranolol.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the patients was 280 over 130. There you go. That's why we can't just focus on numbers. We have to put it into a risk perspective.
We should say that we're not saying that we could even remotely normalize that, but certainly keeping that history in context when you're looking at a 180 on a single visit.
For sure. Yeah, exactly. Okay, and I hope I don't screw up this name. Alon, I think, is the name of the person who sent us the next question. It says, I love to hear this. I mean, that's kind of why we do this, Mike, is that for starters, your podcast has completely changed my perception of medicine and pharmacy. Now, hopefully in a good way.
It was the other way.
Yeah. And they're saying, as a retail and clinical pharmacist, your show has probably taught me more than any university course. So love that. And this person is saying, I recently came into an argument with a doctor who's prescribed low dose, 25 milligrams quetiapine for a patient for a number of years. and that patient has significantly increased weight, dyslipidemia, and now hypertension. But the doctor does not believe it is the medication because of the low dose and because it, in quotation marks, it is not in the monography.
And I think it's pronounced monography.
Monography, maybe? Yes. Yeah, I think it is not in the monography. That's right. That's a better way of saying it. So we all know we're talking about the monograph. So she sent us this email going, and what do you do about it? Because she thought for sure there was evidence that it did. And I'm actually pretty sure that there is information in the monograph about this as well. But
monography.
The monography. Yeah. That's what I meant. And, you don't have to look very far to find reasonably solid evidence that of these, the sort of metabolic side effects that some of these antipsychotics do produce. And I sent her an article that discusses the metabolic side effects of the second generation antipsychotics. And I even sent her a case study of low dose quetiapine actually being associated with metabolic problems. So there's no doubt that they can do that. So I guess we could probably just say, well, you just phone the person up and tell them they were wrong. But why don't we go through a process of how do you deal with when you get these sort of black and white statements? Well, it's just not in the monograph, or no, I don't believe you, and so on and so forth. Because here's where it gets tricky. It is not a guarantee that because this person is on quetiapine, that it is because of that. Because many people have an increase in blood pressure and cholesterol and weight when they're not on these agents. So,
and in fact, two of the people delivering this podcast may fit into that category.
Well, I'm on a very low dose. Oh, no, I see what you're saying. People. No. Hey, that's just rude. I'm working hard. I'm working hard to keep my boyish figure.
I will not comment.
No.
Yeah, keep going. You were on a run.
Yeah. Well, so is it possible that this medication is doing? Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. But there's no guarantee of it. And so in this case, I think really the only way to tell, and this is often the only way you can tell about a specific medication, is it causing a side effect, is to stop the medication and see if that improves anything that has happened. And, a lot of it depends on what this medication is being used for. If it's, a life-threatening illness, you may not want to stop it. Or if they were, floridly schizophrenic, and this is the only drug at the dose that actually could stop them from wandering the streets and all that sort of stuff, you probably wouldn't do that. But, I think the answer would be to, do they really need the medication? Is there an alternative? And if you stop it, do these things go away?
Yeah, it's a trial and error, because as you point out, we really don't know with most adverse events. That's why in clinical trials where we look at total adverse event counts, it's 80% in the treatment arm and 60% in the placebo arm. So
yeah.
Things are happening to people. They're gaining weight, they're getting in car accidents, they're losing their hair, etc. So it's very hard to tell. The only way to know is to experiment off it. We know quetiapine is associated with this. I've found in my practice, and I don't know if it's actually, and I don't know how you'd ever research it even, but there are people that are specifically sensitive to these second generations.
Yeah.
Where I've had patients on similar doses of, let's say, olanzapine, and they get no weight gain. And then another poor fellow who gained over 100 pounds. And the real challenge was it was the only effective medicine. So really, in the end, we ended up trying something else later because it just became so high, the weight, and it immediately came off, which was wonderful. But these things are hard, and it's only experiment. I think the bigger challenge for our pharmacy colleague is to how to get this their physician colleague to look at the monograph or to reflect on this a little more delicately without offending anyone. And that can be tricky. Some people you'll never be able to get through to, and other ones through subtle methods of, well, maybe I'm wrong, can I check it out and let you know, that kind
exactly,
of thing.
Yeah. So some of the ways and again, there's no RCTs of this sort of approach, but you could you know, one of the ways you could say is that, I in no way mean that I would want to put the patient in between the two healthcare providers, but what one could say is, you know, the patient is very concerned about this, and you know, we've had a discussion about it, and I've mentioned that it is a possibility, so I'm not really sure what to do now. Can we work together to try and solve this? Because the patient is concerned about it. And if there is a way, so it doesn't become a battle between two different health disciplines, it's really, you know, we're trying to help that patient sort of thing. There is no great way to deal with people who are belligerent. It's very tricky.
Hey, I do a podcast with one.
Really? What's the podcast called? Because...
The James McCormick Show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, mostly, not a lot of people listen to it. Okay, God.
Yeah. See, that was a pharmacist physician interaction right there that went
exactly.
Very well.
Went south very, very quickly, and you know, your New Year's resolutions really didn't last long.
No.
Okay, they didn't. So let's just do one more, and this one might be take a little bit of time, but let's see how we get with it. So this is Amy, and she's saying that she uses our podcast to keep up to date with a lot of information, and really enjoyed the podcast that we did a while ago on labs and the variation in the measurements and how to figure out what to do with diabetics and hypertensive patients. And she was asking, in particular, what is the evidence for the frequency of ordering things like microalbuminuria and urinalysis and TSH and vitamin B12 on metformin? Any insight into the evidence with these diabetic hypertensive patients in mind would be very helpful, as I feel we probably overdo the testing in the primary care clinics I work in. And so, thank goodness we have Dr. Allen on the line, who is going to tell us exactly what to do with every one of those tests, because he's the expert in it. So go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, so I have no clue for most of things. Yeah. But let's talk about the TSH. That's the easiest one. TSH, yeah. For patients who are asymptomatic in any format don't need a TSH done. The only group that might vary in is pregnant females. That's where the recommendation is equivocal, but in other adults and diabetics and hypertensive specifically, you don't need to test TSH. Looking at your analysis.
No, and I'm just going to say, and if we go back to the lab podcast that we did and the variation, you know, TSH literally has to change. I think it was one of the worst test when it comes to the amount of biologic variation that's there. It has to change, and I just don't have it in front of me, but I think it's around 60% before you can comfortably say it's actually changed. So it's fraught with problems, not only as using it as a diagnostic, but also as a monitoring tool.
Yeah, and we've known from, we did this on one of the premium podcasts about the new trial that showed that treating subclinical hypothyroidism did not result in better outcomes for patients. And most of those were kind of the kind of 4 to 10 TSHs.
Right, right.
Let's talk about urinalysis. Urinalysis should generally not be tested. I know some people tested in diabetics for sugars and for proteins, etc. But the better test, if you're going to use one, is a microalbumin creatinine ratio. Because the trouble with the urinalysis is it's quite indiscriminate, so you're going to pick up a lot of hematuria and things like that. That you actually, especially in younger people, you're going to end up sending a lot of people for cystoscopy and that kind of thing. So urinalysis in the general population is an absolute no-go, and I personally avoid it in my diabetic and hypertensive patients because I don't like it's got too many markers of too many things, and it just leads to problems. It's indiscriminate. So if you're going to test in diabetics, there is talk of testing for microalbuminuria. James and I have been doing the podcast just shy of 10 years, and we are still promising that we are going to talk about microalbuminuria and the challenges with it. But I will tell you, I'm working on a tools for practice right now that deals with ACEs and other medications. Are they required in diabetic patients? And the main outcome there is microalbuminuria, it turns out, that's changing, which is, as you know, a surrogate. Still, I think most guidelines advocate for the testing of microalbuminuria. I'm not necessarily against that, but if you do, one of the key features is don't overreact to ACRs, albumin creatinine or microalbumin creatinine ratios, because they vary widely, very widely.
And before you do any of it, why don't you in your head go, okay, what if it comes back negative, what would I do? And if it comes back positive, what would I do? Mm-hmm. You know, what changes would I make? If you're already treating your hypertensive and diabetic patients in an adequate way based on the best available evidence, I'm not sure what else you could potentially do.
Yeah, the only argument is, the debate is around, and I haven't finalized the evidence review to say, but the debate is around the patient in your office whose BP is 130, they have a slightly elevated microalbumin creatinine ratio, and you're stuck with, do I start an ACE inhibitor
or not?
And I'll have that for you a little later.
Yeah.
B12 and
no, and I was gonna, I mean, I'm also gonna add in though, and here's where it gets tricky, because with looking for protein in the urine, albuminuria, it has to change at least 75% to 100% before one can say it's changed.
Yeah, I know it's crazy, and we know that from clinical practice.
Yeah.
Because in fact, the guidelines reflect that. They say once you've tested a positive, then wait. And I think the Canadian guidelines are 3 months or 6 months and retest again. And if it's still high, then you can call them proteinuric. And this is where then you can start to argue for a urine analysis, because you want to find out, and you'll see that in most, renal guidelines, where they're, if you've got protein, then check out and see if there's blood there too, because it can change the diagnostic features and whether they need referral to nephrologist. But
yeah.
That's something I often don't have to go down the road of. And then the last one is one I will fit in here is CBC. We've talked about that. Don't order that in an asymptomatic patient, whether they're diabetic or not. And then B12 on metformin. This is a great question. If anyone knows of any research on this area, we'd love to see it, because we've thought about doing research on it ourselves. And it's very difficult to, it was difficult for us, it was 10 years ago we were going to try and do something. We have better access to data now, so we might look at it. But I don't presently know the impacts of metformin. I know that it's it can contribute to leading to B12 deficiency.
Yeah.
But what's the frequency of that? I'm not sure of.
Yeah, and I actually did look into it a little bit, and it's hard to get this information. What I could find is over 5 years, 2% more people on metformin get vitamin B12 deficient than those on placebo. That was... roughly it is. But here's where you're going to run into a problem. The unbelievable variability of that B12 test means you're going to get a lot of false positives. It's not an easy black and white answer to just say, just measure it and go from there. So, you know, it's great that you guys are going to maybe do something on it. But again, vitamin B12 has a lot of biologic variation in it, and it also needs to change 60% to 70% before you can be sure it's actually changed. So there is no great answers that we can give you for this, which is maybe why we leave it to question and answers. Because we just sort of get depressed when we do a podcast where we can't give you really useful information. But these are very difficult things to deal with, and we realize why you guys struggle with them.
Absolutely. These are testing for these, and the whole thing about if you've been in practice a while and you remember back to when we used to test urinalysis and everybody, we were doing it in the Canadian Forces when I was there. And I can't even remember but it was a very high proportion of patients who had a positive for blood in their urinalysis, and we would chase them and they would have to stop exercising for a while and then we would and rest, and then we would test them again, and if they were positive we might be sending them to urology, and I'm sure the urologist hated us for that. So
very similar to how the eMERGE docs hate it when they send the 180s over 110s to the emergency room.
Yeah, exactly. And I will just say, I looked on the, which is if you're really into providing good kidney care, there's something called the kidney the CKD, chronic kidney disease, mm-hmm. Clinical pathway in Alberta. And it's a relatively good resource to kind of help triage what you need to do with your patients. And it gives some good ideas about when you're, you know, so it's saying once your GFR and your albumin creatinine ratio become important, that's when they need to sort out whether there's hematuria present. So if you look at this pathway, it's a GFR less than 60 or an ACR greater than 3.
Yeah.
So that's when you need to, that's when you'll need that urinalysis. So
yeah.
And helpful.
And a GFR of 60 means basically you've lost about half your renal function.
Yeah. And it turns out that if you're in many of our practices, you're around age 70.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. You pretty much lost at age 70, you pretty much lost half of everything.
You know what? We could go, it becomes very cruel, actually, this conversation.
Exactly.
So we're going to drop it right there. Well, you and I are closer to that than we'd admit.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think we'll leave it at that for this podcast. As always, please check out our website. Please check out Tools for Practice because they are, I mean, you guys are putting them out every hour now. No, every 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's
roughly.
Right.
And
it's 1 hour, 2 weeks.
Yeah,
same thing.
And we've put out the brochure for the course that's coming up in Vancouver on May 4th and May 5th. So you can see who the speakers are, you can see the topics, you can see everything. So you can get a link to that on our website. We would love it if you would attend. May in Vancouver is usually beautiful, although it does rain sometimes. So we can't guarantee great weather. In fact, we actually prefer it when it rains because then more people stay at the course. So
I noticed I wasn't on the speakers list at all this year, James.
Oh, yes, you were, Mike. Don't. Now you want me to say something nice about you. I'm not going to.
No, you know, how I get so weepy.
I know. No. Mike will be there. We with, you know, God willing. So, I think we just have to go from there to thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.